Hey everyone, welcome to a special episode of The Doctor's Playbook. Now, usually this podcast features conversations with physicians about the art of clinical reasoning, teaching, and patient care. But today's episode is just a little different. We're interviewing someone who is not a physician, but works very closely with physicians in his day-to-day work. My guest is going to be the Reverend and Professor Clayton Thomason, who is really impactful in many different domains, both in healthcare and outside of healthcare. So what we're doing today is exploring the ethical, spiritual, and human questions that shape medicine, questions that doctors cannot answer alone. In our conversation, we talk a lot about what it means to be human in medicine, how ethics and spirituality influence the care we provide, and many stories that have shaped his career and have led to pivotal moments in bioethics and healthcare. This conversation is not just about medicine, it's about meaning, values, and the questions that stay with us long after a case is closed. I think you'll find it both grounding and inspiring. Today, I'm thrilled to be sitting down with the Reverend and Professor Clayton Thomason, who holds the Bishop Anderson Endowed Chair of Religion and Ethics in Medicine at Rush University Medical Center, where he serves as Associate Professor and Chairperson of the Department of Religion, Health, and Human Values, and Director of the Healthcare Ethics Program. In these roles, he oversees spiritual care and ethics consultation services, one of the nation's leading programs in clinical pastoral education, a robust research program in spirituality and health, and graduate education in healthcare ethics. Professor Thomason's scholarship and teaching span biochemistry, bioethics, law, medical education, and spirituality. He holds a JD and a Master's of Divinity. His current work focuses on community-based participatory research on congregational wellness to address health disparities, the role of virtue in professional development, and public policy in palliative and end-of-life care. He has published widely and is a frequent lecturer on issues at the intersection of ethics, law, and spirituality in medicine. Beyond Rush, he has served on the board of the Chicago End of Life Care Coalition and the Pulse Illinois Leadership Task Force. He's a trustee of the Berkeley Divinity School at Yale University and St. Augustine College in Chicago, and was elected a fellow of the Institute of Medicine of Chicago. Earlier in his career, he chaired the Michigan Commission on End of Life Care, whose recommendations were actually signed into law. With a background in both law and divinity, his career bridges professions and perspectives, guiding students, clinicians, and communities through the most complex moral and spiritual questions at the heart of healthcare. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Andrew. It's good to be here.
Well, we're really excited to have you as a guest. You are certainly the first with your background to be on this podcast, which I know will be a lot of fun and certainly very interesting. So I guess just to kick things off, you know, reading your bio and learning a little bit more about you and prep for this interview, you've had a really fascinating journey. You know, you've had this law degree, you've been a pastor, a professor, an ethicist. And I'm curious, how did these threads come together to shape your vocation in healthcare?
Well, vocation is the right word. And I started much like everybody else did. I was pre-med, you know, just like you. And I was sitting in a biochemistry class, as a matter of fact, and asked the professor some question like, you know, what does the Krebs cycle do this instead of that? And she said, no, that's the wrong question. Why? That's a question for philosophers and theologians. She said, as a scientist, I can tell you what and how. And I got to thinking about that because it's the why questions that I've always found so interesting about medicine and healthcare. Those are the existential kinds of questions.
Wonderful. I love that answer. It, you know, reminds me of my own moments in undergraduate education. I studied both biology and philosophy because I found that there were gaps in my biology coursework that were filled with the more intellectual existential questioning and philosophy. So it's interesting to see that someone of, you know, your training has had that experience early on in your education as well. So I guess, you know, when we think about healthcare and what led you there, you're at this intersection of spirituality, ethics specifically, and medicine. So what drew you to that component? Because obviously you could have gone any number of directions with your experience.
So I kind of went from science to philosophy to law school because I realized I needed some kind of professional grounding from which to do work in bioethics and then to divinity school to, as you suggest, kind of fill in some of the gaps and really address some of the practical issues and clinical ethics and bioethics broadly.
Sure. How do you feel like your training in law and then I guess also in divinity equip you to lead conversations in healthcare ethics?
Sure. I think it gives an interdisciplinary perspective on an interdisciplinary field. So the field of bioethics is inherently interdisciplinary, and it invites both the scientific voice and the clinical voice, as well as broader social and existential questions that people have.
Hmm. Do you feel like when you made that decision to study mm-hmm. philosophy and then go into your law degree, did you know you someday would be doing what you're doing today, or did things switch along the journey?
I knew that I wanted to integrate fields. I wanted to be able to do the interdisciplinary work that I saw people I admired doing. And so I sort of knew that there were going to need to be several steps in that preparation.
You've been studying ethics for many years now.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think has been, if there has been, the big change between when you first started studying ethics to what you're seeing now in the ethics world?
That's interesting. It's an interesting question. I think early on, the field of bioethics in the 70s, 80s was actually predominantly a field of theological ethics. So it was Protestant and Christian, Protestant and Catholic Christian theological ethicists who were initially called on by medical colleagues to help give some structure to new advances in medicine. So bioethics from its inception has had this challenge of chasing the technology or the new development in medicine against the background of the philosophical question of the naturalistic fallacy. Just because we can, should we? Can doesn't imply should. Mm. Right? Well, the actual fact of the matter doesn't require the moral imperative. So I think I've seen evolve from the way I was taught then into the sort of maturity of the field of bioethics, which represents this attempt to do work such as Beecham and Childress, the four principles of bioethics. They said, here are these four principles: autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice. Put them out there on the table, and everybody can agree that those are four important principles without having to agree to all of the premises that might lead you to those principles. Yeah. So it was a way that we could have a secular pluralist bioethics. There have certainly been ups and downs in how well adopted those principles are, but for the most part, they've really reflected, from the Belmont Report, before that even the Nuremberg Report. But the Belmont Report was really the sort of basis of American bioethical principles, in that it laid out, so codified these four principles as being critical to, first of all, research involving human subjects. Mm. And so that was the sort of inheritance from the Second World War, the Nuremberg Nazi physician trial, and then the sort of report thereafter said, whatever we do, we don't want to go back there.
Right.
So what do we need to do to build a kind of bioethical consensus in Western medicine?
Yeah. Yeah, that standard is interesting and wonderful, I guess, that we've developed. I'm sure it's helped, progress the field in some ways. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, though, you mentioned the pluralistic setting we're in.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically in a pluralistic medical setting, how have you been able to help navigate people, balance maybe what they would, their individual beliefs with also this shared ethical standard?
Right. It's not all that easy for some people, and it's going to be easier for some than others. So one of the ways we try to navigate that is by recognizing that there are domains of the human person beyond what you see. And so, I bet you've learned the biopsychosocial
right.
model of what it means to be a human person, mm-hmm. whether that's a patient or a provider. And in addition to that, then came along this notion that there was something missing in the biopsychosocial model, And it was the place where people knit together their sense of meaning, purpose, and value from those other domains of human experience. And so the modern kind of conception of that is that there's a biopsychosocial and spiritual experience to what it means to be a whole human person. It's an anthropology of the human person for medicine. And so it's not just about doing the right physical medicine, diagnosis, treatment, sure, in the absence of paying attention to how it's making someone feel. What's that psychological or emotional or cognitive dimension to the human experience? And then, of course, people with bodies and feelings and thoughts are also embedded in social networks, families, ethnic communities,
right,
religious communities, mm-hmm, they can be too. And the spiritual domain is not necessarily religious. It's an important thing to, I think, recognize. The spiritual domain can be existential without being rooted in a particular religious tradition. We also certainly recognize in chaplaincy the rootedness that each of us brings to whatever and our experience of religious tradition is. And so we try to think about being deeply rooted in holding loosely one's own tradition. And then you can sort of speak beyond it to meet the other person somewhere in between.
That's fascinating. I love that perspective. Thanks for sharing all of that. It makes me wonder, and I'm sure people are wondering, someone in your position with these perspectives, with your skill sets, and with your roles in a hospital, could you just describe what a typical day in the life or a week in the life of your role looks like for people who might not know?
Sure. So I'm on call for the ethics consultation service. And the way we do that is you're on call 24/7 for a week. Mm-hmm. And so the nice thing about that, aside from that we don't get a lot of calls, so it doesn't often wake me up in the middle of the night, but sometimes it does. The pager will go off and I'll get a call. And we try to think of two different kinds of consults that we do. The one is an informal consult, and that sometimes takes the form of just, this patient's lost decisional capacity, or we think he's lost decisional capacity, and so we're looking for a surrogate decision maker. He's divorced and has three adult children. Who's the decision maker? Who should be the default surrogate decision maker? Well, it turns out that Illinois, as in other states, has a default surrogate act, healthcare surrogacy act, that describes exactly what the order of precedence to the basically family members are for a surrogate decision maker. Mm. And so those are the kinds of questions that I can just say. It's one of the three adult children. They can decide which one. But you need a person who can be there to answer questions,
sure,
for you. To speak, in that case, to speak in as if they were the patient. In other words, in the patient's voice, from the patient's perspective, what would he or she want done in the situation? And there might be all kinds of evidence about what he or she might have wanted to be done. They might have an advanced directive that has some commentary in it that might help illuminate whether or not they would want that next surgery, the life-sustaining treatment, or not. Because, of course, if you can consent, you can also have an informed refusal. Any yes has to also be a no, otherwise the yes is not particularly meaningful.
Yeah.
So that's a kind of informal consult that might do, because those are a lot of questions that can just be answered kind of factually.
Sure.
And then there's a formal consult, and that's usually where there's a disagreement or dispute about someone's care. And it might be the goals of care, probably the number one, most frequent kind of consult that we get are, you know, what should be the goals of care for this very sick patient? And always we try to think about, you know, what are the patient's values. If we don't have any evidence of what the patient would want, what's in that patient's best interest? Because that best interest standard is a minimum obligation for everyone involved, whether it's clinicians, staff, the family, a surrogate decision maker. Your main job as a surrogate in particular is to make decisions as if you were the patient, and if you can't do that, then do it in their best interest. Yeah.
Speaking of best interest, you know, I'm sure there's times where there is a clash of what people think is the best interest.
Yeah.
How and who helps guide to the final end? Because eventually something has to be done. And, you know, I'm assuming a lot of these are end-of-life decisions, very critically ill patients. I imagine a lot of your work might happen in an ICU setting where, you know, to sit and ponder and reflect might be nice in an academic sense. But when you're faced with decisions that need to be made medically, my questions are twofold. I guess how and who helps decide this? And what is the timing involved with this? Does it happen right away, or is there a convening of a whole committee of some sort?
Yeah, no, if it's a treatment decision and there's urgency around it, we don't have time to get a whole committee together. Mm-hmm. But if it's a longer-term question, we can certainly, as an individual ethics consultant, can refer the case to the whole committee. But again, that tends to be non-emergent. One particular colleague of mine, Howard Brody, used to say, there are no such thing as a stat ethics consult, right? Precisely because you don't want to, you know, rush some kinds of decisions. But where treatment decisions are going to be made one way or the other, I think we try to help frame the decision. We can help narrow down the range of options. But eventually, the people charged with the decision are the patient or their surrogate and the clinician, the attending. And they got to somehow get together and, you know, cut through the other disagreements. I worked with I worked with somebody recently in which case there was disagreement between two adult children, essentially, of the patient. And there was no spouse, and so they had kind of equal standing in the surrogacy hierarchy. And the one said, the other one doesn't know what he's talking about. You shouldn't listen to him. And she kept coming up with different things that were wrong with him that should disqualify him from being a surrogate, even though he had previously been appointed the surrogate by the patient himself. And so, you know, that was simply a matter of trying to talk through it with clinicians and say, okay, you've got a good surrogate decision maker. If you don't have reason to think that he's acting against the wishes of the patient or against the best interests of the patient, that's the guy you go with.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. I'm curious to know, like, what is your process flow for, you know, for that case, for example, you get the consult. What do you do? What's the first thing you do? And then what's the order of operations you follow? Do you review the medical records? Do you try to stay, how do you stay unbiased in some, like, what's the process of an ethicist in this situation?
Yeah, so the first thing I'm interested in when I get a call is after I let whoever's calling debrief a little bit, because it's often emotionally charged, the thing that I'm looking for in their narrative just depends on who it is and where they're situated in the patient care decision. Because we can take referrals from anybody. It can be a family member. It can be the patient themselves. It's very often a nurse or a resident or an attending. Anybody in the system can request a consult. And the first thing I'm looking for is what's the ethical question? What makes this... Not to put too fine a point in it, but what makes you think this is an ethical dilemma? Because sometimes that'll actually resolve the dispute. If it's not really an ethical dilemma about, you know, someone's best interest or the autonomy of the patient, trying to not harm the patient, right? Non-maleficence, mm-hmm. trying to benefit the patient, beneficence, or is some injustice being done? If it's not one of those kind of primary principle clashes, what is it? And sometimes it turns out that these are just, I shouldn't say just, they're important, long-standing family dynamics mm-hmm. that are important to deal with, but that don't rise to the level of stopping someone's care, standing as a barrier to someone's care. And sometimes, on the other hand, the thing that that can delay decisions is that the rapidness with which someone's condition deteriorates. So perhaps the patient's been medevaced here from somewhere downstate or some other referring hospital for a stroke. It's part of the stroke program.
Right.
Right? And they get in the chopper and the family, the wife, the parents, whoever it is, mm-hmm. Flies here with them, and they get rushed into, and it turns out that they aren't able to preserve much brain function after all is said and done. And yet, here they are, a day later, family's told that something, there's nothing clinically left to do. This patient is, we're going to expect a miracle. Mm. Have you ever encountered this in your training?
Not that specific scenario yet, but I'm sure it's going to come.
It's not an unusual thing for someone to say. And the challenge is very often how that family simply hasn't had a chance to catch up with the clinicians who are saying, well, we knew what the prognosis was before this patient got here. We knew there was a very small chance of being able to do what the family would like us to do. And so I think that the chance to meet that family and say, What is it you're expecting? Mm. And what do you think that would look like? Sometimes what the family needs is to catch up. These developments happen really quickly, and the clinicians are able to say, well, we've been thinking about this for days, and we have lots of other cases to compare this to. Whereas for the family, it's an N of one, and they've had, hours to days to kind of reconcile with what's happened. So those are the kinds of situations in which having a chaplain on hand might be helpful to someone to help them process their grief around the declining health of their loved one.
Sure.
And when it happens suddenly, I think it's harder for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know who said this, but I heard it somewhere. Someone said, remember that today might be another work day for you, but to a family or to a patient, it might be the worst day of their life. And that always struck me as a way to remain grounded. I certainly mm-hmm. don't remember it all the time, but I think about the future of my career and navigating, many scenarios, maybe similar to this, people who are critically ill, having that worst day of their life. And part of me does worry, will I be able to remain grounded in that reality of the patient and family experience? And my question for you is, how do you remain grounded in remembering that? Because you see these a lot as an ethicist, as a chaplain. So what's your way to remain grounded?
So when I think about groundedness, I often think of Thomas Merton's description of how easy it is to lose sight of what's ultimately of ultimate value and meaning and purpose. And I think for me, that has the effect of stopping me before I go in the room, take a deep breath, and then knock. Because I think part of what can happen to any of us who walk into a patient's car is that we bring all of our busyness and rush and hurry with us, you know, like a whirlwind in the door. I think of this when teams are rounding, and there's so many people there. They're standing outside the room, inside the room, and they're, you know, giving a report, so forth. And I think we owe it to patients, their families, but we owe it to ourselves and each other to try not to get caught up in the frantic. Mm. So why?
That's great advice. That's good perspective. You know, actually, it reminded me, I had heard that approach before, this simple breath before going into a room from Dr. Vivek Murthy. He's the previous Surgeon General of this country. Listened to an interview with him where he talked a lot about how he would try to remain present in the gravity of what his patients were experiencing. And it makes me wonder also, as a future physician and a leader of a team, what benefit it might have to say that out loud to your team before going in, you know, maybe a, you know, it could be 5 seconds. Let's just remember how severe this is for this patient. Let's take a quick breath, pause, and then we'll go in and do what we had already planned on doing. Because there is a sacredness to these moments, despite what you mentioned earlier, the you know, emotional, the aggression maybe, and anger and frustration related to all these issues can get in the way of just the heart and the gravity of what's going on. So that's really interesting to...
I'm glad you used the word sacred. Mm-hmm. So I think that captures some... how you can set apart, which is what being sacred means, set apart the moment they experience that someone's having and honor it. There's a clinical practice that's called the pause. I know people have used it. It's like when you do, they call it an operating room.
Oh, the timeout?
Timeout, that's it. Only it's... it's a pause that acknowledges the sort of humanity of the person who you're treating or who's in the room, and the humanity of the other members of the team at the same time. And then
I like that. I'm going to have to look into that. It makes sense. It's like, as a surgeon does a timeout prior to operating, so too should the communicator of big news or decisions to a patient.
The communication of bad news.
Yeah.
That exercise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of work to go there. It reminds me of Atul Gawande. He's a pretty famous writer and surgeon.
Sure.
And he, wrote that book, Being Mortal.
Yeah.
And in an interview, I believe it was with Krista Tippett from On Being, she was interviewing him about, you know, his work in palliative care and hospice care, being from a surgeon's perspective. Mm-hmm. He said that he was shocked at how hard it was to train that skill of communicating. He compared it to his early days training in surgery, and that it's something we take for granted, that to truly be an expert in communicating such large and life-altering news, it takes time, it takes effort, it takes reps, just like it takes for him as a surgeon, hundreds and hundreds of cases to become the expert at a certain case.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
I heard that. I heard the same interviewing on Being.
Nice. Wonderful. Do you feel like now at this point in your career that you are an expert in this type of communication?
No.
Why not?
What does it take, 10,000 times?
Sure.
Practicing 10,000 times, I'm still a work in progress.
Sure. And maybe we all will be this whole career, and I suppose that's what makes it interesting. Now, I'm curious if you're able to share, you know, any stories of a particularly memorable, challenging case, something that's stuck with you over the years. Do you have any that you're able to share?
Clinical consult. I think I told you about a couple.
Yeah, yeah.
I know there are other cases that I haven't consulted on, but been useful in teaching. Mm. Because among the things that I like to do with students in ethics classes at the end last week, their last assignment is to find a story about bioethics in the news that illustrates something about where the future, sort of what you were asking earlier,
sure,
where the future lies, what's the future of bioethics. And of course, one of the cases that many of us around the country have been following this past year was the Adriana Smith case in Georgia. Mm-hmm. She was the woman who, at 30, I think, had blood clots in her brain and was declared brain dead, but was pregnant. And so the decision was made, and purposely used the passive voice there, because that's part of the challenge, was that the decision was made by her providers in the hospital that she couldn't be taken off life-sustaining perfusion and intubation, because it would amount to not killing her, because she was already dead, but it would amount to abortion of the fetus. Mm-hmm. And so the body was kept warm perfused, breathing, intubated, and until they could do a cesarean section to deliver the child. When this baby was delivered at like a pound.
Wow.
And then she was able to have the life-sustaining procedures stopped. Mm. But I think part of what the case represented for many in the bioethics community, certainly, was this notion of sometimes called maternal-fetal conflict, where the interests of the pregnant person and the interests of the fetus come into conflict with each other. And if this has been really called into question by a number of states that have built into their abortion laws, mm-hmm. A clause about fetal personhood. So if, as if to really nail shut the boundary, if there's a fetal heartbeat, then the statute in Georgia, for example, gives that person legal personhood. Mm-hmm. It's really, and so anything you do that causes the harm to the fetus,
sure,
is just like assault and battery on an adult.
Because of the law that was put in place, right? Mm. Yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah, thanks for sharing that case. That oftentimes I think the public's view of ethics and medical ethics is from these large cases, yes. Which is interesting, because oftentimes those are the most, I don't know if severe is the right word, but they certainly catch the most attention, which is why they make the news, of course.
All the famous cases. Terry Schiavo, I was teaching about her case in a law and medicine seminar. We come in every week and turn on the latest from TV news,
yeah,
to see what development was in the works. She was, it was never quite clear exactly what the predicate cause was, but she had brain damage from some kind of brain event and was confined to bed and was communicative. But she had, it's not locked-in syndrome, it's
like a persistent.
Persistent vegetative state, thank you. EVS. Yeah. Persistent vegetative state. And her husband said she wouldn't live like this.
Right.
And her family, her parents, mm-hmm. like a sibling or two, said, if there's even the remotest chance of her survival, that she would take it. Actually, they didn't say she wanted that. They were more concerned about what would be in her best interest. So
sure.
The husband claimed that in all the court proceedings that she would, her substituted judgment would be, I don't want to live like this.
Right.
He based that on having, they watched a TV show of someone else who the news one time. And,
wow.
And she articulated this to him some years earlier. And so he was making the decision based on that substitute judgment standard, and the parents wanted to make a best interest claim. Mm-hmm. They fought it out in court in Florida and went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the legal outcome of it all was that the right of the patient to direct their own care, mm-hmm. even beyond when they can speak for themselves, through the substituted judgment standard,
yeah.
was upheld. Sorry, it was a cause célèbre at the time. It's part of the culture wars between kind of pro-life and pro-choice.
Sure. Yeah, and I'm reading here that it lasted a long time. Her accident was in 1990,
years.
And her ultimate death was in 2005.
Yeah,
it's remarkable how, like you said, up to the Supreme Court, it even led to political involvement from, the president. Which is fascinating.
They passed something in the Congress called Terry's Law.
Yeah.
Try to resolve this. Mm-hmm. It's always a bad idea. How does that relate to a single person?
Right. So, bringing it back in a little bit, to think about, we think about laws that are in place, and the law is a law. People have different thoughts on certain laws. I'm curious, whether you're speaking for yourself or just theorizing about it, how you would reconcile moments where the law and compassion maybe demand opposite things. Because we all have a thought on why it might need to be compassionate in a certain ethical situation. So how do you reconcile those moments?
Well, to be compassionate is really to suffer along with the other, someone. And if that suffering is the patient's, that's one thing. If the suffering is the providers or the staff, the family members, the people around that patient, that may be something we have to bear for ourselves. So it's very often, sometimes I should say, it's our distress, our moral distress, that we're acting to assuage. And so the notion of moral distress itself, this literature, a lot of it started here at Rush in research with nursing staff. And it turns out that if you think you know what the right thing to do in the situation is, in your example, compassionate thing to do is, but you can't do it because you're prohibited from doing it because of, if you're the nurse, for example, you don't have the final decision in treatment decision. The attending does. Same thing if you're a resident or a medical student or a chaplain. In all of those cases, you might encounter this kind of moral distress as a result of that incongruity between what you think should be done and what can be done. So it goes back to the philosophical notion of the is-ought distinction. This is the way things are. I don't think that's the way things ought to be. And so if you're the one who's being caused to have that sort of moral conflict, it may be something that each of us needs to be able to work out on our own without doing the patient's.
Thank you for sharing. Now, in terms of practical advice you might give clinicians, residents, et cetera, who may be the ones putting in these consults, what would you say? What would you say to, a year from now, I'll be an intern resident in internal medicine. What's your advice to me when I come across inevitably a case that may have an ethical question that could benefit from either an informal or a formal ethics consult? What would you say? What's your advice?
Be aware of what you think are the conflicting ethical values or principles that you're encountering. See if you can distinguish between your moral distress and the patient's well-being, patient's care or the barriers to care, and then communicate that effectively through your consult.
Okay, that's great advice. And then I guess maybe more so of a intellectual or existential advice, what would you say to healthcare professionals about finding meaning in a system that can so often feel overwhelming?
Sure. Don't rely on the system to do it. You need to be rooted in your own meaning and purpose and value as clinician, but you know, as a person first. You're taking care of at least that sort of hierarchy of needs that you have. You may not be able to do a lot to change the situation for others. Start by having the best tools, disposal for yourself.
I think that's smart. I think pulling from earlier in the conversation, maybe instilling the pause, not only in clinical care, but maybe in multiple domains of life.
Right.
Yeah. Wonderful. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we finish this conversation?
Thank you for the opportunity to share the time with you.